Good afternoon. My name is Karen Meacham. I'm Deputy Director and Fellow within the Global Health Policy Center here at CSIS. Today I have the tremendous honor of introducing Dr. Michael Merson of Duke University, who will discuss the explosion of interest in global health on university campuses across the country. Dr. Merson, I feel, personifies what has inspired a generation of students to go into global health with a career dedicated to service through medicine and public health. He's worked tirelessly to address disease and health disparities worldwide. A brief review of his work includes being chief epidemiologist at the cholera research lab in Dhaka, Bangladesh, researching acute diarrheal disease, including cholera. Dr. Merson has held many prominent positions within the World Health Organization as well, first being the director of diarrheal disease control program in the 80s. In 87, he was appointed director of the acute respiratory infectious control program, and in 1990, became director of the WHO's global program on AIDS, where he was responsible for mobilizing and coordinating global health response to the HIV/AIDS pandemic, very big at that time and continually. In 95, Dr. Merson became the first dean of public health at the Yale University School of Medicine, and through 2006 went on to direct research on HIV/AIDS prevention at Yale, something he's done significant work on. He's led training programs to build capacity on HIV/AIDS prevention in Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Dr. Merson is widely published and also serves as an advisor to UNAIDS, to the Global Fund, Gates Foundation, and many other prestigious institutions. In his spare time, he has played a key role here at CSIS, most recently becoming a member of the Commission on Smart Global Health Policy, where he lends his voice and expertise to the policy debate here in Washington, D.C. Today, Dr. Merson will talk about his most recent work as the founding director of the Duke Global Health Institute, where he uses his experience to educate and guide the tremendous population of students towards careers in global public health. He'll also discuss the Consortium of Universities for Global Health, which was recently formed to define and direct and encourage this wave of student interest. So with that, thank you, and please, let's welcome Dr. Merson.
So I'm on now. Thank you very much, Karen. Let me first say that for your very kind remarks, but really what I want to first say is that CSIS is a very special place, and thank you for inviting me to be here. I have come in many different capacities. Steve Marson couldn't be here today, but Steve and I go back to some of the early work that was done on AIDS here and the visits we made and the commission, task force really made a huge difference on the Hill. And I have great admiration for what CSIS does. To me, it's the epitome, the example of what a Washington, quote, think tank or Washington group that really wants to make a difference in the world should be. And I have great respect for it, and I'm just delighted always to be here. I also want to acknowledge in the audience, particularly given the topic, a few people like Jim Sherry, who's the dean at the public health school here at GW, and Guy Pfefferman, who works with a lot of the business schools, and there may be some of you else here from other academic institutions, and if I say anything that isn't right, please raise your hand and correct me, or if you feel differently, please say so. I'd like to keep this somewhat informal. I didn't expect a room like this, but I want you to feel that you can comment or ask questions as we go along. We wait to the end. I don't feel strongly one way or the other. What I want to do is do three things. I want to talk about the context of global health, and then I want to talk about the consortium that we're in or trying to set up and what's going on in some universities. And again, I hope some of you will chip in from your own experience. And then talk a little bit about, in the end, about how I think the U.S. government can, maybe universities could partner a little more, and what universities can do in global health in general, that given this incredible enthusiasm that is going on today. I should tell you that one of the bottom lines I want to start off by saying, looking at the audience, but if I had one message that I'm going to give you, is that we owe it to students. We owe it to today's youth more than anything else. I was talking to John Donnelly this morning. You may know him. He used to work for the Boston Globe. And we were talking about what's, from the perspective of the media, what's made the big difference and what's really caused this global health phenomenon to occur. And I think there's a universal feeling that we owe it to the students. So those of you who have recently been students or are still students, you are really behind a lot of what's happened today, and you should be proud of that. You're way ahead of the faculty and the deans and presidents of universities in your enthusiasm and understanding of the field and what it means. So for those of you here, I don't know how many students are here. Are there any students here? But oh, great. Okay. I'm glad I said that then. So what is global health? I often get asked that question, what is global health? So the students who just graduated, what is global health? I mean, I don't know whether any professor ever asked you that question. So we've tried to say what global health is. And here you see an effort. Study, research, and practice. It's an area, not a discipline, involving study, research, and practice. Our focus is on equity. It emphasizes transnational health issues, determinants, and solutions. It involves many disciplines within and beyond the health sciences, promotes interdisciplinary collaboration, and is a synthesis of population-based prevention and individual-level care. That's a mouthful. So if you want to read the paper about it, about a month ago now, I think, there was a paper in The Lancet. A bunch of us in the field from developing countries put out this definition, and I'll show you another slide in a minute. And we've had a lot of interesting letters to us, many people who don't like it, many people who do like it. And it was put out there to start the debate. It's not meant to be the end of the debate. It's just an effort to try to define a new field. New fields come and go in academia. Women's, 20, 30 years ago, there was this whole, women's studies, environmental studies. You know, academia is slow. Those of you who are in academia or remember academia, things don't happen quickly in academia. But new fields do start, and this is a new field. And we're going to figure it out, a good definition, as we go along. So this was not meant to lock anything in stone. And you can see, I have to do it this way, that this is not projecting very well, but I will just say here, this is trying to compare global health, international health, and public health. Three terms that are very frequently used. So here's that definition of global health, okay, that I just went through. Transcends national boundaries, global cooperation, prevention and care, health equity for all nations, highly interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary within and beyond sciences. So that's the essence of global health. Now, what about the term international health? It's a term that's still used in many textbooks and around the world. And for the most part, it's talking about health issues or of other countries other than one's own. It usually involves binational cooperation, and it has prevention and care, and it seeks to help people of other nations. So when the term international health traditionally means when the UK wanted to help its colonies, when the French wanted to help its colonies, and when the US years ago felt, foreign aid was helping others. We weren't really, it was nothing to do with our health, it was helping other people. That was the term, that's really where the term international health more or less comes from. And then you have the term public health, and of course, this gets a little grayer, the difference between public health and global health. And there is room for more discussion, perhaps. But public health, for the most part, it doesn't focus so much on issues that transcend national boundaries, but more on populations in a particular community or a nation. It's not as often involving global cooperation. It's more focused usually on prevention than care. and its health equity issues are usually more within a nation or community, and it's not, it certainly is multidisciplinary, but more within the health and social sciences. So there's a grayer area between global health and public health. I accept that, and we're trying to figure out ourselves together with our colleagues, you know, having been a public health school dean, how we're going to work this out. I think with the international health is a very clear difference in the way we approach global problems. Really, international health was a one-way street. In global health, we do mean global health, the world as a whole. We can come back to that if you're interested. Now, one of the issues within the context of global health is the challenge, and there is a mistaken, I think, belief that global health is infectious diseases. And we really need to dispel that in terms of any of the parameters that you want to look at of what the leading global health problems are today. Certainly infectious diseases, HIV, TB, and malaria, and particularly in the poorest nations, in sub-Saharan Africa in particular, we wouldn't doubt that. But chronic diseases, clearly cardiovascular disease and obesity and diabetes and hypertension and cancer are more and more becoming the leading killers in the world. Everywhere, even, I mean, those of you who travel in urban Africa, how many friends do you have in men in their 50s who've died of stroke? It's really become an epidemic. 20% of Chinese are hypertensive men. So we know that chronic diseases are really the coming problems. When I'm asked, you know, what are the big health problems in the world? What's the big risk factors in the world? Well, certainly you'd have to say AIDS, particularly in Africa. But smoking and obesity. You have a billion people on the planet, 1 billion, that are going to die from the consequences of tobacco. So how can we just think that global health is an infectious disease? It's just not what the data shows. And then, of course, the environment. I often tell my students that my generation didn't do a very good job dealing with the AIDS pandemic, and it's going to be up to this generation, our new student generation, to figure out how much we're going to suffer from climate change and air pollution and the environmental threats around us. And they are real. We got too much water in places. We don't have enough water even in this country, as you know, in the western part of this country. We have terrible drought. But serious, the environmental consequences, the health consequences of our environmental problems are huge. And they have to be in the realm of global health. Social determinants, you know, it's not just the diseases, but the determinants. We work in global health. What I again, emphasize, it's not just the diseases. We're not just doctors treating diseases. We have to be as concerned with why they occur. What are the social, economic determinants? Gender, poverty, education, culture, we can go on and on. And then, of course, the issue that always gets neglected, the system. As someone who's worked for many years, I have some guilt about this. As someone who worked for many years in vertical programs, we all thought back in the 90s and 80s that if we just did immunization programs or diarrhea programs or malaria programs or this program, we would drive the health system. And we would strengthen the health system by making our vertical programs work. Well, how wrong we were. Because here we stand now in a situation where our health systems are really in need of strengthening as health systems, not because they deliver AIDS programs or MCH programs or any other programs. But we need to focus on health manpower issues. We need to focus on the system, on the management of the system, on the policies of the system as a system. Or our interventions, we've learned, we're just going to go so far in what we're going to be able to achieve. That's a critical component of global health. So when we think of global health, in an academic sense at least, that's just a quick picture of the kind of things. And there are others. You know, I haven't mentioned road accidents. I mean, migration issues. We can go on of some of the other priorities. Mental health, huge issue. Neglected for the most part right now in the field of global health, but one that's crying for attention in the field is the field of mental health. So I just want to make, I mean, it's a critical point in understanding the field. Now that is, here is a projection of global burden of disease, and it's just a bunch of arrows, I know. But what it shows here is that between 2004 and 2030, we're going to see a shift in the global burden of disease. And what's going to be number one on the right there is depression. So in 2030, our leading cause of disability-adjusted life years is going to be unipolar depression, and then heart disease, and then road traffic accidents, and then cerebrovascular disease, and then chronic lung disease. So that's where the world is headed. So when you run a, when you have the privilege of running a global institute, and you're thinking about what your research priorities are, and you're thinking about the world in 20 years, those are the issues that are going to predominate. We're still going to have our infectious diseases, for sure, and our pandemics, no question. But the world, as we develop more and populations get richer and more middle class, where's the largest middle class in the world right now? Okay, I don't know how many of you would have guessed, but it's certainly not the United States. It's India. And China's a close second. We'll soon overtake India. That's where the global burdens are. Mostly in these transition countries, and even, as I mentioned, in urban Africa. So, again, thinking about the context of which we deal with global health. Now, global health, though, is not just disease and determinants. These are all the actions, reasons why we need to take action on global health. Let me get some water. The first one is security. And, my God, I'm in a security institute. and you've defined it. The best example are pandemics. I think. How many of you know? What's your estimate of the number of pandemics that we new organisms? Let me put it this way: new organisms that we have each year that have been discovered. Anyone want to guess? Say about one a year. We get a new organism or an organism that comes back, becomes emerging. That was sort of dormant, almost one per year in the last 40 years. Two-thirds are viral, and two-thirds are zoonotic. And that's what's leading to a lot of our pandemics. That's a good example of security threats. What if H1N1 had a 50% mortality rate? Probably I wouldn't be here. But what if H1N1 had a 50% mortality rate? I mean, just think about that. Would you think about that? What that would mean? It might eventually have that. Hopefully not. But what if we have a new pathogen that comes along with that kind of virulence? That could certainly result in serious security problems for everyone. Diplomacy. Sometimes global health works when other politics don't work. Where is the U.S. most popular in the world today? Africa. Why? PEPFAR. Whatever you think of the previous administration, you have to give that administration great credit for PEPFAR. Whatever the reasons for starting PEPFAR, it's done a tremendous amount to promote United States abroad. And, you know, President Obama talks about improving America's image abroad. Global health's a great way to do it. Science. Most discoveries in science today are not one person who has a brilliant idea and they figure it out on their own. That's not the way science works anymore. Most of our great discoveries are step by step. You know, most Nobel Prize winners, I think two-thirds do their discoveries before the age of 35. But they do it by working together and building on science that others have done. So global cooperation around science is huge. And that's how we make our discoveries. So global health is terribly important for science. Sustainable development. I think one thing that's really clear now is that if we're going to have healthy populations, if we're going to have development, we need healthy populations. And if we want healthy populations, we need development. The field of development economics across U.S. universities has really come forward again as a great specialty area. And more young people going into economics are going into development economics, thank goodness, because it's a field that had been dormant for a number of years. Commodities. Global health is $3.5 trillion business in the world. Drugs, vaccines, diagnostics, prosthetics. So from the standpoint of the business world, global health is big. Has a lot, a great importance to the business sector. Global public goods. Global public health goods means that there are certain given rights, not rights, but certain given actions that we all benefit from, like smallpox eradication. That's another reason why we take action on global health, because we want to achieve some global public goods. Another one is the Convention on Tobacco. That's another global public good. And then another, finally, reason why we take action on global health is because of human rights. I would say for students, certainly in the past decade, the price of antiretroviral drugs was a major factor, and the human rights issues around that were a major factor in interesting a lot of young people and bringing a lot of human rights activists into the field of AIDS, was the fight over the price of antiretrovirals, which are now down to, you know, almost less than $200 a year, when they were $15,000 a year when this whole AIDS pandemic started. And, you know, that's a considerable drop. So there's a great achievement in health and human rights. So, again, the field of global health, it's not just diseases. It also is determinants. But it also involves security, diplomacy, innovative science, sustainable development, commodity, business, global public goods, and human rights. It's why the field is interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, and captivating so many people around campuses. Now, of course, in the context of talking about what's going on at universities, there's the question of development assistance. And this was published in last week's Lancet. If you haven't read the paper, I urge you to read it. It's just showing you the growth in global health. 22, well, if you can see, it's between 1990 and 2007. And you can see it's up to $22 billion in assistance for health now by 2007. And you can see the bottom is AIDS, and there's been significant growth in AIDS and malaria. But that's substantial. Look at that growth. And then here's the growth in the United States. Almost $10 billion last year from the U.S. government alone in global health. That's a significant, it's more than a doubling in 5 years. And then if you ask where the money has gone, and this has been a great change, of the $9.6 billion in 2008, you can see this is from Jen Cates' stuff at Kaiser, almost half is now at state with OGAC. So, of course, the AIDS PEPFAR has played a major role in that, and AID, of course, and then the rest with much smaller except the NIH budget, which is about 10% of global health money, although a small percent of the total total budget of NIH. So you can see here that's the growth in the U.S. So, again, the context that global health has a lot more resources internationally and nationally. Now, this is a slide based on a talk that Steve Morrison gave. U.S. policy, though, despite all this funding, does have some interesting challenges, and I'm going to come back to this at the end. There are like 21 different agencies in the U.S. government that are involved in global health. No offense to anyone here from an agency. It's just a fact. 21 different agencies doing global health. Most of our money is going into AIDS. We have an interesting debate going on whether global health is public health or foreign policy. And our global health policies tend to be Africa-centric, and they overwhelm, in some cases, other bilateral programs. And we have an interesting tension in our global health policy in the U.S. between vertical and horizontal efforts. You saw that from the previous slide, all that money going into AIDS, almost nothing going into health systems. So I think we're at a very interesting time in the U.S. and globally. We have a lot of money, and we have some interesting policy decisions we have to make, taking into account the previous slides I showed you on global burden of disease and what we even mean by global health. The last point I want to make before I get to universities is the current economic context. Very often I get asked, why are you even talking about the rest of the world? What a mess we're in. Well, shouldn't we worry about ourselves? I mean, why are you even thinking of the rest of the world? Well, these are just some facts. The poor are the most affected by economic downturns. The poor are most affected because they have to spend more out of pocket. There's less expenditures by government, and there's less foreign assistance. So we know that in the face of an economic decline in the world, the poor are going to suffer the most. We already have heard, it's been in the press, that up to 90 million more people are living in poverty this year alone. We anticipate there'll be an additional 400,000 deaths in children in low and middle income countries and 45 million more children malnourished over the next 18 months. Similar impact expected on women's health. We'll talk about this at the end, but this is why it's good that the Obama administration is thinking of a maternal and child health initiative. And certainly a cut in foreign assistance would reverse the hard-won gains that we've had in the past 5 years in a number of areas. It would undermine global surveillance of flu and TB and other important organisms, and it would hurt our image abroad. You know, the word out there on the streets, the U.S. created this crisis. So it wouldn't be so smart politically for us to cut back our foreign aid at the same time. I mean, that is what you hear on the street. So I would argue that we've got a challenge ahead of us, but this is not a time to cut back our efforts in global health. Okay, so let's turn to universities now. What I hope I've done there is I've set the context for you on what global health means in a broad sense. Definition, disease problems, the multidisciplinary nature of it, its importance beyond the health sector, all these issues I mentioned of security and commodity. And I've given you a picture of the finances right now. So let's talk about universities. Now, this is just one slide, which shows you in one of our programs at Duke, our Global Health Certificate, which is a program for undergraduates. So in 2007, there were 2 students. It was a new program. And by 2011, there'll be 60. This is just undergrads at Duke, taking what we call a certificate. It's what you would maybe meant some of your students have minors in your college, so this would be like a minor. And I'll talk a little bit more about Duke later, but I'm only introducing this as the example. There are many universities that can show you a slide like this in 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 of their programs. And the question is why? Why has this happened? Why have we seen this enormous growth on university campuses? Now, I don't know the answer to it, but I'm going to give you some ideas, and maybe some of you are going to give me ideas. So I've got a list of ideas here, but I'm going to go right to the bottom idea first. And David Brooks wrote a column in the Times around when there was a lot of talk about why so many students were out there campaigning in the last election. And I thought his observation was very interesting as it applies to global health. And what he said was, our current young generation has an unconsummated desire for sacrifice and service. I don't have any data to prove that, but I believe it. And I'd like to think, you know, I'm from the 60s generation, those of you who joined me in the 60s generation. I think we had some of that. We were reacting to a war, many of us, in Vietnam. I think the students of today, they're reacting too to things around them. I was teaching last semester when I went to meet some of the freshmen in our Focus program. We have a thing called Focus, which is for freshmen, and 30 students in the class. And I asked, how many of you, first week of class, how many of you are just coming to college? How many of you are in high school went abroad? Over half raised their hand. How many of you have been to Africa? 40%. As high school students. When I grew up, it was a big deal to go to New York and see a Yankee game. Okay? When my wife grew up, it was a big deal to get in her truck and go to Chicago to go to Wrigley Field and watch a Cubs game. Okay? So that's what it was like when I grew up. But the students who grow up today, they're in a whole nother world. I don't think our faculty get it, but all of them. But the students that come today, they've got these devices, I don't know, these social networking things. I just heard about Facebook, you know. But since they've been young, they've been on the web. They've seen it all. They hear it all. They got friends all over the world. Now they've got all these Twitters and Twatters and social networking, and you know, I don't get it, but they get it. And so they've got an information technology boom. They got rock stars out there, right? Everyone knows, say Bono, what do they know? Everybody knows, it's U2. I just learned that. But they know that he means something. He was able to really push for global health. The G8 is terrified of him. Okay? So I think that you have movie stars, you have rock stars who really have caught on. George Clooney. I mean, we can go on. I'm learning some new names, you know. But I think that this is you have, and then you have the social justice movement that I already mentioned touches students on the access to drugs. And then you have what I somehow find hard to quantify, and that's this response to the 9/11 and Iraq war, and this desire to show we're a better nation. Okay, it's hard to quantify that. So you have all these impacts on the current generation, and then you have other factors. You have the pandemics in the news, SARS, AIDS. I have avian flu. I should put swine flu. I mean, so we have all these pandemics that make it, food illnesses. We have a pathogen that gets into food from Mexico that comes here. We have all these diseases that travel with food importation. And then we have, of course, the philanthropy. I've already mentioned the government's money, but look at Bill Gates. Gates Foundation, by far, the biggest foundation in the world. $3 billion a year on global health. $3 billion a year. And Bill Gates himself has just, you know, as you know, left Microsoft and is president of the foundation. And then, of course, the faculty. I think what you're finding, because global health is so interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary, you get faculty from almost all schools, at least at Duke, from all our schools, and in arts and science, from many departments, that feel that they have a role, they see their place in global health academically or from the education standpoint. But I come back to the last bullet, which is that this generation really cares. For whatever the reasons, this generation cares, and global health and, I hope, the environment are the two things where they can really demonstrate that they care. And so I use that, again, as my final point here. Now, I'll show you. It's not just the students, not only the young people. When was this done? About a month ago, Karen, the Kaiser survey in May? Anyone hear from Kaiser? No, okay. March it was done? Okay. So this was a nationwide survey of what does the American public think of global health. It was published on the web. Got some PR. I'm just going to show you a few of the slides. So the majority of people, this was a nationwide survey. The majority say that developed nations are not doing enough to improve health for people in developing countries. 57% not doing enough of the people surveyed. Even in the current economic climate, this is from March. 28% doing enough, 4%, 14% didn't know. But 57% of the American public, and this is really interesting. So the question was asked, tell me why you think the U.S. should do more to improve health in developing countries. Look at the predominant answer. It surprised me. 47% because it's the right thing to do. It's what it comes back to what I was saying about students. This is from the American public, the national survey. And then this really surprised me. Have you personally ever donated money to an organization that works to improve health for people in developing countries or not? The first circle. 50% gave money last year for something to do with health in the developing world. That's an astounding figure. Now, much of that, I think, it's not in the survey, is through churches. And that's fine. I mean, so it's hard. I don't have the detail of the breakdown of who they gave money to, what organization. That's an impressive figure. So I think the student context has to be seen in the population context. And then this issue of enlightened self-interest, where we have to be honest and say it's students care and the public cares, but our government interest and our political leaders' interest is also there's some enlightened self-interest. We're afraid of outbreaks and pandemics. We want to repair U.S. image abroad. We want to ensure economic development, and we want to fight poverty. So I don't want it to sound like this is all just being good guys. There's also an enlightened self-interest part to the interest in global health. I don't think it's the predominant one, but I think we have to be honest and say that that our own government's interest is somewhat due to enlightened self-interest. But I do think the fundamental drive on American campuses, I want to come back, is the students. In the context of the public interest and in enlightened context of enlightened self-interest. So last year we formed a consortium. Well, we had a group of 20 universities that got together and say, hey, let's talk about what's going on. And we decided, we had a meeting out in California, and in September 2008, we got 20 universities together. We're going to have a second meeting this September here in Washington. We've invited 52 universities. Now, in that initial 20, we said, okay, we're going to invite initially 20 universities that have multiple parts of their university that are involved. They have some university resources. They're designated. There's a designated leader. Education and research activities are part of their portfolio, and they have overseas collaborators. And so we 20 met, and we decided to formally form this consortium. And now we've invited 53 schools. We have a board of directors now. We're incorporating ourselves as a 501(c). It's going to be called the Consortium of Universities in Global Health. Our secretariat, we're housed for the first 3 years at the Global Health Science Division at UCSF, and we have some initial support from Gates and Rockefeller, but we're going to, of course, have to charge dues, like all, you know, most university groups. But what's exciting about this meeting coming up in September is we invited 5 university presidents. We figured, you know, we're going to try to be a university consortium. We're not going to be a medical school consortium, a public health school consortium, a business school consortium, because most universities are trying to approach global health across the university. So we thought we'd take a chance and make this a university consortium. So we invited 5 university presidents to speak. We didn't know how many would accept. We had no idea. All 5 accepted. So we're going to have a meeting with 5 university presidents coming and talking with us about what to do with the consortium. That's not small fish. I mean, that you can get 5 university presidents to come to a meeting, and they're pretty busy people. Of course, once one new one was come, the other one says he's coming. But still, I mean, this is still an impressive, and we really hope to launch this consortium. And we want to promote the university's role in multidisciplinary capacity for tackling major global health challenges. We want to build university collaborations to define global health competencies and set standards for training. We want to strengthen the university's capacities to provide seamless global health experiences for students and researchers. We want to provide a platform for exchange of knowledge and experience in global health. These are some of the initial goals we've put forward, but we'll work on this more at our meeting in September. Actually, NIH is hosting us. We're very pleased about that on the 14th and 15th of September. We did a little. Now, one of the things I don't have to show you, I wish I had to show you, is data from these 53 schools. How many students are doing what? How many faculty are doing what? I don't have that data. We're still young. Next week, we will be starting to survey all 53 universities with a common questionnaire to try to get this data for our meeting in September, also for our event on the 16th, Karen, because we want to have some data that we can show is going on around the United States, and also 5 universities in Canada. This has become a big issue, big hot field in Canada as well. We did do a quick survey of our own, and we found that 41 of the 52 schools do have activities that are into school. 26 universities are actually giving hard money to their global health entity, whatever that is. 44 have education and research programs, and 41 have formal partnerships or exchange of students and research. We've got to do a lot better of documenting what's going on. Right now, what I've told you is just, you know, from my own experience, but I think this is our goal over the next couple of months. This slide is too small, but I was going to just say, the reason why I put this slide up, this is Duke, Emory, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, University of California, San Francisco, University of Washington. I put those up because each one of those universities has somebody on the initial board of directors. But the reason why I put it up is I want you to realize that each university is approaching global health in a different way. There's no magic formula. So at Duke, we have a I'm privileged to direct, we have a trans-university institute. I'm half-owned by the provost and half-owned by the chancellor of the health system, and I sit under the president. That's one model. Emory also has a trans-university institute, very similar model. Harvard, being Harvard, has a diverse structure for global health in various parts of the campus, strong in the public health school, strong on the in the health policy, strong on, in arts and science on the, in Cambridge, strong in the hospitals like the Brigham. No real unifying structure, not yet anyway. Hopkins has a Institute of Global Health, but it only involves medicine, nursing, and Institute of Global Health, but it only involves medicine, nursing, and public health. It doesn't involve the rest of the campus. I'm not saying good or bad. I'm just giving you the different scenarios. UC San Francisco is setting up the first university school of global health. It's going to be a very unique situation where they're going to have a center in each of the UC campuses that exist now, and then they're going to have a central core, and that's being debated now where that will be. I know California has a budget crisis, so I don't know how fast this is going to occur. They did get a $4 million grant from the Gates Foundation to get this started, but this is going to be the first school of global health. Quite an interesting concept, making use of the entire California system. It'd be quite an experiment. And then University of Washington, they have a global health department, which is made up of a combined effort by the medical school and the public health school that has a lot of support from the Gates Foundation. And I could go on. I mean, we can come up with probably 30 different scenarios. It doesn't really matter. But what I wanted to present to you is that there is universities are working to figure this out in a context that works best for each of them. And there's no one way to do it. But the important thing I want to show you is that this is happening across the country. Now at Duke, you allow me 5 minutes of a promotion of my own institute just to tell you a little bit more about the way we're doing it, okay, without much detail. But I'm doing it to emphasize a few points. What happened at Duke, just to give you an example, is that there was a committee established 2 years before the institute ever was created to decide what Duke should do in global health, and they decided to have an institute that would reduce health disparities in our local community and worldwide. We consider global health to be global and local. If you go east of I-95, in North Carolina, you almost enter a developing country. I mean, it's pretty sad, the kind of disease problems we have in much of the South, as you probably know, particularly in rural areas. And we are very interdisciplinary, and we are focused on solving problems, that's research and training the next generation. But the most important thing is that our institute spans the humanities, social sciences, engineering, environment, law, divinity, and the life sciences, which are medical school and nursing school. We don't have a public health school at Duke. So I think it's an example of how one university put it all together. And our five goals are to build the next generation of our institute, is to build the next generation of scholars, that's education, encourage innovation and promote excellence in research, respond to the policy needs of decision makers, undertake research, service and service learning, and facilitate access to current information. This slide just gives you a picture, I'm not going over this, of all the different education programs we've started, the various research initiatives we've started. That on the left is the number of service programs we've started, and on the right is on policy. I just want to tell you one thing that we did on the service side, which I hope more universities are going to do. We found that our health system has a lot of surplus supply and equipment that goes on eBay and frankly doesn't sell very well. This stuff is fine to use. It's just a little out of date. And we convinced the head of our health system to let us take those supplies and equipment and give them to our faculty who are doing research abroad so they could give it to their partner institutions as a way of giving and as part of our partnerships with the various activities we have abroad. So that's just a way in which you can get your health system rather than putting their surplus on eBay and barely probably, you know, storing it at a huge price, instead they gave it to the faculty to give to our partners abroad for the kind of research we do. So just to give you an example of how a university can do things quite uniquely when it comes to global health. And then this is a map of the places where we're doing research around the world. I would say that probably Hopkins has the most international. I think the last time I talked to Tom Quinney, Hopkins had projects in close to 100 countries. So I think they have the most partnerships around the world. You can see we're quite modest when it comes to that. And then we are also been working with a number of partners around the world to designate what we call global health sites, where we are hoping to concentrate our research and education efforts from the different schools, because it gets expensive and you build up close relationships, equal close relationships with partners. And if you're doing an AIDS research, you know, in Tanzania we started off in AIDS, but we're now working in maternal and child health. Our engineering students are there working on some projects. We have an environmental group there. We're working on some projects. We have students who from the various schools. What we find, and what more and more universities find, is that it's most effective in creating close bilateral partnerships, partnerships that go in both directions, rather, that it helps to concentrate your efforts. And you'll find that, I think what you would find is more and more universities are doing that. We're actually having a meeting next week at Duke with six other universities in the southeast, between Washington and Alabama. We're having a meeting with six universities to talk about how we can share our resources and how students from one school can go to a place that another school has a site where education or research can take place, so that we don't step on each other's toes, be sensitive to our partners. Let me then now just close a few minutes about what I think is some of the issues that we face down the road. So I was thinking, what are the challenges that we face in all this enthusiasm that's out there? First, within academia, those of us in global health, we still have to convince our colleagues on the validity and sustainability of global health as an academic field. It took years for women's studies to be accepted on campuses. And I don't expect this to happen overnight. This is a new field. And we have to prove ourselves that we are serious scholars and going to make a serious impact from an education or a research or a policy standpoint. Secondly, we have to be sure there are reliable career paths for students. Students are not stupid. Students think about what's going to happen when they graduate. Well, they should. Most of them do. So there has to be career paths. Thirdly, we have to make it a truly global field, not just a field in the north. So I mentioned that Canada has five universities with global health institutes. Well, England now has four. Peter Piatt has just gone to Imperial College to start a big global health institute there. I think he spoke here recently. Australia has the George's Institute, which is a leading institute in global health. And we've been invited now to start global health diploma programs at Peking University in Peking, at Mahidol University in Bangkok, and then went with the Public Health Foundation of India. Because at least in Asia, we're seeing that more and more universities want to create academic programs in global health. Again, very much driven by students in those universities. So I think we're going to see this worldwide. And I know a number of my colleagues are doing similar activities in Africa. We need to determine benchmarks and ways to measure the impact and success of our programs, and we need to maintain the exciting momentum for global health under the current global economic downturn. And therefore, I think we need to keep asking ourselves as universities, what can we offer to the field? What do we offer that you can't get from CSIS, or you can't get from Family Health International, or you can't get from the U.S. government? What is it that universities can offer? Or from NIH? What is it that universities can offer? And these are just some thoughts. Obviously, we can capture the enthusiasm of students and educate and train future leaders. Our scholarship and research of our faculty can address the leading global health challenges I mentioned. We can do objective, hopefully, policy analysis. And we can provide service to our local partners to civil society, to the U.S. government, to international organizations, and to the private sector. What I mean by that is particularly is in the area of monitoring and evaluation. We've been involved in my institute in a number of projects around the world in the area of monitoring and evaluation, where we've been called on by usually a funder to come in and do some serious evaluation work. Now, in terms of partnering with the U.S. government, this is a challenge for us. There is this thought that, with some validity, that universities are slow and we take big overheads. Although I must tell you, I've seen some others that take even bigger overheads that are not universities. But I think the question that we need to ask ourselves is, how can we partner better with the U.S. government? Traditional relationships have been mostly through HHS, of course, NIH, CDC. Department of Defense supports quite a lot of research on universities, and the Department of Education, mostly through Fulbright scholars. All that could be expanded. Then we need to think about new relationships with state. As I showed you, state now is half the global health budget of the U.S. government. Hasn't been a lot of collaboration historically between state and universities in the area of health. And that's an area I hope can be established. And then, of course, in the area of policy analysis, I'm sure we can do more to work more closely with the U.S. government. And so I'll finish with this slide, because I want to come back to where I started, which is that what's driving us more than anything is, and I think we should all be very excited about that, is today's youth and the fact that they want a better world. And, you know, Martin Luther King, this quote, as long as there is poverty in the world, I can never be rich. As long as disease are rampant, I can never be totally healthy. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single dominant destiny, and whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. The point here being that health disparities are not something we should tolerate. And people who go into this field, I think what's at the core of why they're doing it is that they want to remove those disparities. And that's why it's an exciting field, and I hope one that'll be around for a long time to come. Thank you.
Thank you so much, sure, Dr. Merson. For that well-rounded description of the growing interest in field of study, global public health. I have lots of questions, but I do want to open it to the floor, as I think there's, in the interest of time, and I already see some hands. So maybe there are microphones around the room. If you would identify yourself, and I'll take two or three at a time. Great. Harlan.
Thank you, Dr. Merson. Thank you, Dr. Merson. It's a really interesting talk. I appreciate it. I agree with you that I think you put your finger on in the very strong interest that young students have in doing the right thing and social justice as part of the reason why people go into the field of global health. But I'm worried there's a yawning gap between that humanitarian ethos and what has caused global health issues to get on political agendas over the last 10 years. And if you look at the issues that are on the top of the political agenda, aside from HIV/AIDS, but the avian flu, H1N1, the international health regulations, the virus sharing controversy with Indonesia, they bear no resemblance to the burden of disease studies, as to, you know, what public health conceives of as the future issues of global health. And I worry here that we're doing a grave disservice to the students who are coming in with this humanitarian ethos by not giving them training in international relations and foreign policy to understand what role global health really takes in world affairs and how to act on that to make things happen for global health. So I would hope that possibly one of the goals of the consortium that you're starting is to bring in schools of international relations and bring in international relations training into public health education. Thanks.
Mike, that was a terrific speech. I just want to encourage you to give another tiny addition to it, because I think you've, if the metaphor is right, you've underplayed your trumpet or whatever. Because Duke is a university which was one of the first which encouraged different schools to collaborate. And I remember the conference a couple of years ago on health workforce issues, where the president of your university brought together everything from divinity to the business school. And you also did this pioneering survey of people at WHO, et cetera, showing a tremendous awareness of the lack of basic management skills, and that's where I wanted to go. And you did mention health systems, and you did mention that very little money was going towards health systems. But I wish you'd say a little bit more about these issues, because unless you have people in the trenches who know how to get things done, much less will be getting done, and the money won't be useful. My name is Guy Pfefferman. I'm the CEO of the Global Business School Network, and we're working together.
One more, maybe? Could you identify yourself?
I was wondering if you could further pin down the definition of health system strengthening. I've seen a lot of solicitations out of the government in recent months where they're calling for it, and it's not entirely clear to me that they know what they're asking for. They kind of, sometimes it's M&E, sometimes it's evaluation, sometimes it's actual capacity building and HR, and sometimes it's actual systems. Is there any kind of consensus as to what that phrase is going to mean long term?
Yeah, so your comment is quite interesting. The school, so we have nine schools at Duke. The school that's most involved with us is the public policy school. And the students, many of the students who are involved, undergraduates, their major is public policy. I take your point about the disconnect. I tried to show one slide in that regard about how our money is being spent and what our priorities are and what the global burden of disease is. And it's why I'm hoping universities could get a little bit more involved in policy analysis with the U.S. government, because I understand, you know the whole genesis of PEPFAR. I think it's public that PEPFAR came about not just because there was a terrible AIDS pandemic. There was issues around the African-American vote, and there were issues faith-based. The faith-based sector was losing people, literally losing people in Africa. So I think that the importance of global health in the context of international relations is huge. Certainly at Duke, we are focused on that. I was asked to talk the December before last. It was the annual meeting of the Schools of International Relations that is held every December or something. I was asked to come and speak to them. And I was impressed that there was interest in the public policy domain or international relations domain. One of the challenges they faced was not having faculty to teach courses. And the reason why I say that, one of our greatest challenges right now, not just at Duke, but in academia, is not having enough faculty to meet the demand, both for the education, the courses that are needed and wanted, and the research that's out there, and even to participate in more in the technical support role. How do you get more faculty motivated? How do you get more faculty? Well, either you try to take existing faculty and give them incentives to do their work internationally. And most faculty they have their thing, and they do it well, and they want to do it better, and then they want to get promoted. It's normal. I don't have any problem with that. But sometimes if you could just get them, if they're interested in obesity in middle class people in Durham, maybe you can get them interested in obesity in China. I mean, maybe. You send them on a trip and you give them a small pilot grant, maybe they get enthused. Or you try to bring in new faculty. And that's why we need doctoral programs and postdoctoral programs. And we need to find opportunities for young scholars to advance their interests. And that's what I find in the public policy area right now, or in the international relations area, is getting those schools to take this on at the administrative level. Although at Duke, Sanford is great. But I think this is a real challenge, but I take your point. And how to get the U.S. government to take a more balanced view on where to put its money is complex, because right now two-thirds of our money is invested in AIDS. And historically, that's going to be hard to change, in my opinion, because you've got a lot, 2 million people, I don't know the number, but 1 to 2 million people on HIV as a result of PEPFAR. It's not going to be easy to pull the plug on that. And the question is, how do we get sustainability of this PEPFAR effort in the long term? I mean, I think in the short term, we've got to continue to provide resources. But if we're not going to get more money, or if we're only going to get a little bit more money, eventually we've got to get that AIDS treatment covered in other ways so that we can do other things with the money. I think that's a real great challenge that the U.S. government has now. It's not going to happen quickly. At least we see that there's an interest in expanding into maternal and child health, which is a good sign. So that's how I'd respond to that. On the management side, Guy is right, and I alluded to it, and it's related to your question about health systems. I mean, think of our own country. Think of the mess we're in our own health system. The problems are, some of them are quite common. You know, what often happens in Africa, let's say, is that someone graduates from medical school, and the next year they're running a clinic in a rural area. They've had no training whatsoever to run that clinic. None. But the government, they got a job in the government, and they're going to go run a government, or they're working for a faith-based organization, and they're being asked to run a hospital, and they've never run a hospital. They don't have a clue how to run a hospital. So to me, what we need in strengthening health systems is we need more people. We're short 4 million healthcare workers in the world. Africa has 25% of the disease burden and 3% of the health workforce. So we have a huge need to have more health workers. The nursing crisis worldwide is huge. Okay. So we have that problem. I mean, we need more people. That's where you get this health manpower. But then we need training. We need to train people, whoever, physicians or nurses or any, you know, or people who get MBAs or get business training. We need to train them in the basic management skills. So to me, strengthening health systems, of course, means more people. It means more hardware. You know, we need more hospitals and health centers. We need more. We need to get comfortable with what's called e-medicine or e-health, because I think the future in reaching out to people is going to be through what three and a half billion people have cell phones today. So you know, the way we're going to reach people is by text messaging, in terms of getting, you know, reaching out on healthcare, I think, and PDAs as they get cheaper. So I think that we need to think about people, and then the hardware that goes in the system, and then for those that are in the system, they need to know how to better manage within the system. Now, evaluation, I think we should evaluate programs. That doesn't jump to mind when I think of health systems. I'm not saying we shouldn't evaluate, but it wouldn't be what I would put in the basket of health systems, program evaluation. It should be done, but I'm thinking something of the system itself. I would refer you to WHO has some very good publications on a framework for strengthening of health systems. I don't remember the exact reference, where you could get, I think, some very good fundamental definitions of that. And Guy, I agree, we need to understand that management needs to be taught in many different schools, not just in business schools, not just in medical schools, not just in public health schools, but the concepts of basic health management, even in this country. I mean, how many medical students graduate and even know what Medicare is? I hate to say that to you all, but it's true. And I think we've got similar issues right in our own country in getting our young doctors and allied health graduates to learn something about the health system they're going to enter when they finish their education. So I don't know if that answered them, but I've tried.
Around, maybe, and then Samuel, and then maybe one more in front.
Mike. There's an old adage about those who can do and those who can't teach. And as the quintessential exception to that, it's good to have you at the helm.
Okay, thank you, Jim. That's Jim Sherry.
How do we get the reciprocity in this? I mean, the other consequence of 9/11 was such a reduction in the number of foreign students who were coming to the country. When we saw how the Green Revolution was managed, so much of that was focused on building the capacities of the network of institutions around the globe, and those basic capacities we find the way to get our students over there, what do we need to be doing collectively to, yeah. to get much more of the scholars from other parts of the world
Good question.
Moving around?
Yep.
All right. Global health is still a concept, and basically, nobody's actually funding global health. What is sustaining a lot of this?
Can you tell that to Bill Gates?
What is sustaining this is funding for specific diseases like HIV, PMR. We've had these waves before, like malnutrition, and there was donor fatigue that died. Other things came up. What could help sustain this is that there might be some other interesting things coming up which might capture our attention, like HIV did. We're not sure of that. Are you concerned that since this is what is sustaining this wave, this sort of specific funding for specific diseases, that this may not be sustainable and it may not be enough to sustain the institutions you're developing? Because I remember people started forming institutes of nutrition and all that, and most of those have basically died down. My second point is that I think just as Duke has formed partnerships with developing country institutions, I think the consortium should do that early, not just with Canada.
Correct. Good point. No, I'll take one more.
Tim Stevens from the Institute on Science for Global Health, Carolina graduate.
Oh, it's all right. We're not in basketball season.
I'm fully aware of that. The question I have is thinking back to about 15 years ago, we had similar issues around developing programs in public health practice. I think it's sort of along Sam's line. And the lack of movement of U.S. students into U.S. government public health programs was, you know, as you pointed out, a component of that deficit. I guess one challenge, and maybe thought about the other attendant programs we need, can we afford the cost of a U.S.-educated global health workforce, or should we be looking for lower-cost models for developing that workforce? And if we can't, I know I'm asking that rhetorically, but maybe we need some other programs to support the students, defer all of the costs, high costs of education in this country that they inhabit. So I wonder if you've got any thoughts about that component of, so we can have those students mm-hmm. consummate those education experiences.
Right. Your question's a little bit, all these questions are interestingly a little bit related around the scheme of, the theme of sustainability and partnership. I mean, these are all very interesting questions. I think Jim's point, actually going from here to the Fogarty Center for a dinner with some people at the Fogarty Center to talk about this issue. What we really want is for our institute partners to be able to get sufficient support around the world to be able to be our partners and not just to have a one-way street. I think Jim's point is extremely well taken. And within NIH, there is the Fogarty Center, which is great for this, but it has, a budget that's probably less than CSIS's. I mean, it's really small, and it's very unfortunate how small it is. And I just think that until we get more support for strengthening institutions abroad, this is going to be a challenge. The Gates Foundation has done some of this. Rockefeller used to do a lot of it, isn't doing it now. We don't have right now the resources that we need to do what needs to be done to strengthen these institutions in developing countries. A lot of the money that was made available through Fogarty in the past decade has been through AIDS research. And if you look at where the best AIDS research is done in the world now, and I say this without question, if you look at where the best research is done in Africa, let's just take Africa, it's the institutions that Fogarty Center strengthened over the past 10, 15 years, through its AIDS International Training and Research Program. It's unquestionable. That's true. And it's the best example of what Jim is saying, that where the emphasis was made on strengthening those institutions, they became great partners with partners in the North. And we need more of that, and I wish I had an answer to Jim's question. We're all trying to advocate that Gates do more of that, Foundation. We're trying to advocate that the Wellcome Trust is doing more of that. That's for sure in Africa. They just gave out a substantial number of grants to seven big grants to strengthen African institutions, to collaborate with UK institutes. But I do think that is a very critical area that we all need to lobby for and try to get more resources for. And, you know, I can only agree with you, Jim. On the sustainability issue, I mean, I've tried to make the same point that I'm also not sure, you know, we want this field to continue. One reason for forming the consortium was to try to share and to give this field a decent berth so that it would be sustainable. And I am aware that some fields come and go, but then some fields like women's studies hang on, and environmental studies, for example. Many universities today have environmental studies, which they didn't have 10, 15 years ago. I think that we have some good reasons to be optimistic. We have the continued support from the government. We have the Gates Foundation, the Gates Foundation took a cut. Instead of growing it at 17% this year, it's growing at 8%. Okay, I mean, we'd all like to have our retirement accounts, be that successful. So I think that we do have some signs, but I think you're absolutely right that we also need to have such consortia work with our partners abroad. And at our meeting in last year and at our meeting that's coming up, we've invited a number of partners from our partner institutions to come to the meeting. Because Gates is interested in forming a similar consortium in Africa and a similar consortium in Latin America and maybe in Asia if the demand is there. So I'm hoping that what you're saying, what you're warning us about doesn't happen, but I think we have to work to continue to build on the enthusiasm that's out there. And I think as long as our students are so committed, that's probably the best hope we have of this field surviving and being strong. I do believe that your last question was on the workforce, right? Your question here. The focus was on the question of where we're going to get the workforce.
Where we're going to get it, can we afford to educate it here?
Right. I think I told you I felt some guilt about this issue as someone who was pushing vertical programs and why I think we finally have turned the corner on this and recognized that the health system, the workforce and all that itself needs attention. You have the Global Health Workforce Alliance out of Geneva. You have the new IHP partnership, which I'm hoping the U.S. will eventually join. Of about 14, I think 11 or 12 nations trying to focus on about 10 or 11 countries together trying to strengthen the workforce. I think we need task shifting. I think we need to realize that a lot of things doctors do, nurses do, a lot of things nurses do, paramedics can do. I think we need to also think about what different tasks different health workers can do, that doctors don't have to do everything. In fact, most things doctors do could be done by another healthcare worker. So I think we need to think about who does what, improve the management of the system, and have some efforts by donors and by the World Bank, who's a major player here. A major player in the IHP partnership is the World Bank. I think we need, and unfortunately Gates is not a player in this. The Gates Foundation has not committed itself to this. It's primarily interested in product development and innovation for specific diseases, which is okay if we have others that are committed to strengthening the health system and the workforce. I mean, I'm hoping the PEPFAR resources and the U.S. government will be more open to seeing our resources used, not just for in-service training to get more people treated, but actually to strengthen the health system. Because I think we've probably maxed out in Africa on how many people we're going to reach with antiretroviral drugs if we don't take what you're saying seriously. There is much more momentum than there was. The question is, can it be maintained and can it be expanded? And I think we have to continue to advocate because it always gets forgotten. Not always. It often gets forgotten in discussions. So I don't know if that's sufficient, but it is better than it was 5 years ago. The question is, can we maintain it and grow it?
More, there's people in the fellow in the middle, right? Yeah, very patient. Please identify yourself.
Oh, wonderful. Another university here. Thank you. Yep. Yes, yes. Oh, okay.
Dr. Marson is a very productive presentation. Thank you very much. Very timely. I have three observations I would like to share with you. I think one of the reasons we departed from international health to global health to de-emphasize the political aspect of health. And it seems like health security or security issue, health diplomacy, I hope health will not be the victim of the politics.
You want to expand on that a little bit?
Yes, I will try. One of the reasons is that I believe what you said, but at the same time, if health is brought only for political purpose, then whole concept of development will be defeated. So I'd rather say we will bring health diplomacy under the umbrella of the development, because that is the worst security system that we have in this world today.
I can tell I'm in Washington.
The second is that I think we need to work on more between your challenges of the universities and the topics that you identified under global health. I think if we can bring more consistency, then we can see our path clearly. And third, which is my bias, because I was trained in the reproductive health in the University of Michigan. If you look at the Millennium Development Goals, 8 goals, 5 are related with health.
Right.
And definitely one of them very significant, maternal child health, reproductive health issue. We were supposed to have, after 2004 Cairo Conference, 1994 Cairo Conference in 2004, and that didn't happen. So I hope, and 40% of the deaths happened due to the, as you know better than anybody else, to the MCH reason. So I hope we can bring that back, because that maternal child health issues is the core corner of the health issues in the, particularly in the developing countries.
Let me just say, I apologize I didn't mention that. One of the greatest travesties is the maternal mortality rate around the world. And that for sure. Now, it's somewhat a technical challenge, as you know. We don't have all the answers, but we sure can be doing a lot better. I just want to say I hope the U.S. government does. I'm hoping when President Obama goes to Ghana, we may hear something about this. But I'm really hoping that we're going to get where you want to be on that one.
Thank you very much.
Okay, sure.
Hi, Lillian Benjamin. I actually was a student at the University of Washington and did a project
for one. Oh, wonderful.
And one of the questions that I actually have is about competencies for the Department of Global Health. Has the consortium developed them, and what will they look like? Will they reflect the needs of students and how they progress in their career, or will they reflect the research goals of professors?
Oh, I can see you had some interesting discussions in the University of Washington. Watch out, Jim.
Hi, my name is Ryan McFarland. I'm a AAAS Policy Fellow at the Department of Homeland Security. And my question relates to partnerships between universities involved in global health and the U.S. government. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about what you see are the impediments and what are the potential targets of opportunity, particularly in regards to the Department of State.
My name is Karthik Balasubramanian. I'm with the Boston Consulting Group, but about to join one of Kate Wetton's teams.
Wonderful.
Center of Health Policy.
Nice.
My question is about the real private sector engagement. What do you think the prospects are? And not just big pharma drug development or big pharma serving as a grant-making entity, but also potentially corporate or utilization of corporate supply chains in mass vaccination campaigns, or even utilization of private sector human capital in university research initiatives.
A good question. So on the first question, Well, I comment on reproductive health. I deliberately, in my talk, showed the dollies and then showed where the money is going because I have a similar concern. I mean, it's sort of a trade-off a little bit because the money that's gone into AIDS, I mean, and malaria, and has certainly galvanized much of the government toward global health. I mean, PEPFAR, a lot of people don't know this. The big thing that PEPFAR did is it transferred the responsibility for global health to the ambassador. I was on the PEPFAR evaluation team. I think Jim was in part of that too. And one of the things that really struck me is you go to the field in PEPFAR and the ambassador, you can sit with the ambassador and talk about global health. I mean, it wouldn't have been that way 5 years earlier. That's a really contribution to PEPFAR, and you know, I don't know, we'll see if all the Obama money is used that way also, but even malaria, the few countries that are doing malaria, it's the same thing, it's at the ambassador level. So I understand the disconnect, and I think what we all need to do from a policy standpoint is keep reminding policymakers what the priorities are and not let politics become the dominant theme. On the other hand, we should capitalize on the great progress that's been made financially and politically for the field. So I take your point, and I think we all need to be balance these issues and for the common good. I mean, there are people like Lori Garrett that are very, very concerned about this. I'm concerned, but on the other hand, I also feel we should capitalize on the achievements that have been made. And on the topics, it's sort of related. I do agree that we need to remind ourselves, as I've already said, get some agreement, and that gets to your competency question. There is an organization called GHEC, which actually I believe you probably know from Seattle, the Global Health Education Consortium. They've been around 20 years developing curriculums in global health in medical schools, primarily. We are trying to come up with a way to, I don't know about incorporating, but certainly having a close partnership between GHEC and our consortium. Because one of our priorities for the next few years is to develop competencies, and I don't think competencies should be based on faculty members' interest. Competencies should be based on what the student needs to learn to be a successful graduate in global health. And I mean, we're starting this year, we've just started a Master of Science in Global Health. And we've spent a lot of time thinking about what our competence should be. There's only one other Master of Science in Global Health in the country, and that's at UCSF. That's very much focused on global health governance. And we've been thinking about what our competencies are going to be. And most of our thinking has not been around faculty interests, but very much around what we see are the priorities in global health and what needs to be learned to have a successful career. I would hope all universities would follow that path. In terms of the obstacles with state per se, I think what we're faced with at state is that you're in Homeland Security, I think you said. But that's new. And the money that's gone into OGAC at state is new, relatively new, 4 or 5 years. State never had this role before. And so I think, in fact, we were talking today before this meeting, one of the things our CSIS commission that Karen mentioned, this policy commission that I'm on that commission, we're talking right now about this question of how we can make recommendations to state about how to provide monitoring and evaluation and, for example, oversight and what role universities could play and other actors could play in working with state. As I understand state traditionally, even through legislation, there's certain laws which limit the amount of input that state can have from the outside. Maybe I'm not saying it correctly, but is that something? So I think I'm hoping that there'll be more openness to allowing the expertise in American universities to provide guidance to state. I mean, certainly if you look at NIH or CDC, there's a lot of involvement of universities in review panels or even in councils, and various mechanisms are used. And I would hope we could see some of that at state. I think a lot of it is the newness and trying and maybe not enough awareness of how to do it. And I'm hoping that this will be one issue our commission is going to take up. Now, on the private sector, I think corporate social responsibility has arrived. I don't think it's just a gimmick. I think it's for real. I mean, let's face it. Much of pharma now has serious challenges. I mean, you know all the layoffs and that much of pharma has faced, which is really not good for research and development, that's for sure. So I think, though, that corporate social responsibility, much of it out of the embarrassment over the AIDS drugs, has really happened, at least in the pharma world. And if you talk to ExxonMobil or the gold mining companies, the mining companies in Southern Africa, or the beer companies, I think there's a genuine, there's always a profit motive in what their livelihood is, but I think there's a genuine desire to help and to be part of this movement and to feel that they can contribute. And one way they certainly can contribute is in management. I don't know if Guy's interacted much with the business sector in terms of how they can help business schools, but certainly they have a lot to offer, and I hope you will, I hope that will happen. I am feeling quite positive about the approach that the business community is taking toward global health, and there'll always be exceptions, and there'll always be issues over patents and pricing of drugs and all that, and I don't want to seem naive, but I do think that the general approach of the business community is positive toward making a difference today. I think it's in their corporate interest to do so. The other sector, which you didn't mention, is the faith-based sector. I think there are a number of positive lessons from PEPFAR, but one of them is that the faith-based sector really matters, and we need to work closely with the faith-based sector. In management training that I mentioned they need, but they can outreach to populations in ways that no one else can. And trying to work with them in a positive way, I think, and making them a true partner in global health, like the business sector, is really important. So I just finish on that.
Anyway, thank you, Dr. Merson, and thank you all for coming. So.